Hi, Charu. Thanks for coming on and talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're here talking about your book, Sovereign Self. To lay the foundation of this conversation, what do you mean by sovereign self? Could you outline that concept and the, this thing that you're working towards in these practices and these ideas that you lay out in the book?
Our body does not enjoy freedom. It is under the laws of nature. Our birth, changes in our body, aging, maturity, decay, death, these are all out of our control. Similarly, our mind and its experiences are often out of our control. They are subject to the changing circumstances. But there is some part of us, Jake, that is sovereign, that's truly autonomous. It truly is free, boundless. And I want to talk about that self, known in Sanskrit as Atma. And Atma is literally defined in the Vedas as Apanoti Sarvamiti Atma, which means that which is boundless within you, even if you experience boundedness or lack of sovereignty in the physical realm and the emotional realm. So, sovereign self is really about discovering that self, owning it, and coming back into our regular relationships, remembering that we are the self and not just the body and mind.
So getting in touch with something that's more essential and more fundamental than the thing that it's captured within, the physical body, the mind, the brain, the thoughts, like something that's deeper than that, because you usually we identify with the body and the mind. So you're trying to get us like pop out of that a little bit and get in touch with something that's deeper. That's what we actually are.
Yeah, from our finite beingness to our infinite beingness, for sure.
Could you talk a little bit about your background and the perspective that you're bringing with you for your teachings and the way that you approach getting in touch with this essential self?
I think I must have been on a quest for a few lifetimes, at least that's the way they say it works out in India. And Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita has said that if you are a seeker of self-realization, self-actualization, then do your work. And if death comes in the, before you reach your goal, I'm going to make sure that you find your guru or you're even born in your guru's family. I must have been on a quest. I must have been desperate because I was born in my guru's home as his younger granddaughter. And my grandfather, Baba Yodhyanath, was a renowned teacher and an Ayurveda healer and a yogi, all wrapped into one. These people are called sadhus in the Indian tradition. They can be householders or they can be renunciates, but they seem to possess a more spiritual inclination in everything they do. And Sadhu Baba Yodhyanath was renowned for teaching about the self, the healthy self, the auspicious self, the beautiful self within, to people around him, and people came from far and wide to learn from him. So when I was born, I didn't have to go looking for a teacher. And the teacher was already there waiting, and somehow, amongst availability of male cousins, my sister, and other students and disciples, he chose me. And he told me pretty early on that you would lead my lineage, whatever that meant, because I was too young to understand it. But by the time he passed me on his mantle, I was 24, I understood what that meant. And so what I bring into my teachings of the sovereign self are really grounded in the Vedic scriptures, such as the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Vedas, the four Vedas, Rig Veda, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva. And that has been my basic education. And of course, it seems like I took my heritage international from a tiny town in India to having a foundation in California, having students worldwide, I feel like I'm still flowing. The river is the same, Jake. It's this tiny ancient river, but it's flowing through new territory.
I'd like to wrap back around to the concept of a guru. When you say that, it seems like there's probably some confusion in the West, like multiple maybe definitions depending on the tradition that you're coming from. When you use that term, how do you think about that, and what's the role of a guru?
Yeah, this word, I'm working on an ebook about the guru now. This word is so confusing, and it also gives images of somebody who's like a rock star in spirituality with mass following, and they're wearing these unique clothes that leave no doubt within your mind that they are spiritual rock stars. They often have a following. It could even be a cult following. And every word out of them is amazing. But the way I'm speaking about guru, then guru has two meanings traditionally. Guru means heavy. Literally, guru means heavy. And in this case, it means heavy with wisdom, heavy with scriptural knowledge. And when we say scripture, we're not talking about dogmatic religious scriptures. We're talking about the written ancient scrolls, the text that we're talking about. So, your teacher, your guru must have a guru. So they're not self-proclaimed messiahs. They must have a guru. They must be part of a chain called a parampara, a human chain, where a guru has taught them and given them those secret words and their meanings from those ancient mystical scrolls called the Upanishads. That's one. So they are heavyweight. Guru also means, gu means darkness. And ru means light. So the one who brings light where there is darkness within our psyche, within our consciousness, that too is a guru. And a guru is one who may be biologically related to you, or they may not be. It's not necessary. But a guru is one who definitely plays an important role in awakening you to your own divine, spiritual, sovereign potential. But somebody who is a guru doesn't remain an authority figure for the rest of their life to you. Unlike what the modern concept of once you are with a guru, you're for life, you're kind of in bondage with them. They are almost like professors of spirituality in the Vedic tradition. They play an important role. You want to learn arithmetic, you have to find an arithmetic professor. You want to learn the Vedas, you have to find a professor of the Vedas. Who, and kind of like the mad professor who's really living the subject. And then once they've given you that knowledge, hypothetically, your own inner guru must awaken to lead you and guide you. And then you become a heavyweight guru figure for some others. And this is how the chain proceeds. I definitely recognized my grandfather not right away. Not even when he was teaching me the Bhagavad Gita or the Vedas or Ayurveda. It was only, and it was more like I took it for granted, Jake. But from who I was to who I have become, from the fear that I had to the courage that I now embody, from the darkness that pulled me down to the lightness that I experienced in my everyday being. I know that my some ears were definitely touched by a guru person who showed me the way to truly capitalize on my human life, my human self-awareness, and to really become a source of positivity for myself and for this universe. And to such a person, my grandfather, I give him the title of guru. So gurus in the ancient tradition had to win that title. It was something like they had the gravitas to win the respect of their students. They didn't necessarily have a social media platform or a website or even a business card. They just had the knowledge. Yeah. So I hope I was able to shed some light on it.
Yeah, so the This is somebody I like the point that this isn't somebody that you have to stay bonded with forever. I think that's an interesting part. So this is somebody who's trying to get you in touch with this inner guru that's already present, and then once you're there, you can not distance yourself from them, but you're no longer dependent on them for that kind of wisdom because you've accessed it within you. Am I interpreting that
Yes.
right?
Yes, it was very common in India to spend a significant or important period of your life with your guru and then bow to your guru, take your leave and go out in the adventure of life and try and figure it out on your own. And when you do, you go, ah, Tasmay Shri Guru Ve Namah. I bow to that guru who showed me the way. Indeed, there is light. So there was no permanent staying in an ashram, being a fan of one person and spending all your life around them. There's none of that.
You mentioned things like social media and websites now. There's, books and all of this, that the beauty of it is that you can spread information throughout the world very easily and for very cheap, relatively. What are your thoughts on the importance of getting in touch with somebody in person versus kind of like doing it from a distance, whether through books, websites, podcast, whatever it is. Like, what are your thoughts on the relationship between those two streams of information?
I had some learning in my life, Jake. I think I was a bit old school earlier, and so I was one of the last people to get onto technology bandwagon and stream my videos. And I insisted that students come find me in Berkeley in my building and be in front of me. But gradually, I took off those 16th century glasses. I saw the opportunity in technology. I also realized that there's a lot of suffering and there is something I know that helps people. And this is a gift from the universe to me. And it can't be just hoarded by me or the people who live in my neighborhood. And so I have embraced wholeheartedly everything that I spoke about, except that I know that's the people who are really meant to be in front of me face to face. Somehow the universe will orchestrate in such a way that they will find a way. But interestingly, I have students as far as China and Thailand and, the United Arab Emirates, thanks to technology. And I have found some amazing souls there, just some amazing minds just blossoming, even though they've not met me. So now I'm thinking I'm going to remove the ego around. I must be physically present for somebody to awaken. That was my delusion. And I'm thinking I just have to do my work, write my books, show up on different wonderful podcasts that I'm invited to, teach my classes online or on site. And whoever has to awaken is on cosmic timing. And it has nothing to do with me being physically present or not. So I'm just kind of letting go of those threads. And as you may have seen, that part of being on the Vedic pathway is to be willing to not think that up till this time I was asleep and now I'm awake and every word out of my mouth is perfect. Instead, we are on a continuum of awakening. And I'm still finding some cobwebs of delusions that I let in.
Well, on that topic of adapting and shifting things based on the landscape with technology, things are moving so fast, and we live in many ways, on the more fundamental levels, things are the same as us being human beings. Like, our minds are the same, our bodies are the same as when these traditions were developed. But there are a lot of differences in the environments that we live in now. What's your way of adapting the traditions to modern contexts, where you're staying up to date with the better parts, but you're not trying to go too far as to degrade the traditional elements? Like, what's the way that you balance that continuum?
This is something I have been thinking about. So when these Vedic teachings were given, the family systems in India, at least where they were given, or Southeast Asia, because India was a much bigger geographical India than what it is now, It included Afghanistan, it included Pakistan, it included Sri Lanka and such other cultures. Back then, the family system was super intact. The concept of dharma or duty for each person and each community was very clear. And as a result, there was less trauma for the child and for the growing individual. What I found in the current times was that some of the teachings feel almost irrelevant because the individual seeker is so broken, so traumatized, suffering from PTSD or complex PTSD. This is my experience, especially in the West, where family systems have broken down. And if I ha and even if I when I teach in India or I have Indian students, I find them not the same because India's coming into prosperity. And so I see a lot of materialism and hunger for material things and greed and selfishness coming up. So I find that the seekers are looking for different things. Either they are looking for material happiness, as in the East, or they are having so much brokenness, what they need is really psychological healing, more than even spiritual transcendence or a divine path towards discovering universal divinity. So, and so I wondered if what I'm teaching is irrelevant. At the same time, I found that probably these teachings could be a bit could be utilized towards beginning level healing, letting the greedy people become less greedy and more content. Instead of grasping and grabbing, be more content. Those who are materially wound up can become more content and seek contentment within. And those who are broken and blighted and blemished can slowly find their sovereign, boundless, ever healthy, unbroken nature within, even though it's broken outside. So then, what I did, Jake, was instead of teaching the pure science of consciousness, which is what I'm equipped with, I started teaching how to heal the mind with consciousness. And so I'm trying to take what gifts I have from the ancient Vedas and give it to people who are broken either materially or psychologically. And then in the teaching to hundreds and thousands of people, I find those five or six people who find enough wholeness to go even deeper in the search of God consciousness or transcendental universal experience of their being. And that gives me such joy because then I feel like, okay, now I'm getting something,
So you're first starting, you're doing it in stages in a sense. So you're starting with just like what are the most prominent pressing problems? Maybe it's greed, maybe it's forms of psychological damage that need to be undone. And you're taking care of that first. And then if people want to go deeper, then they can go, you can go deep down the rabbit hole. But first it's like you're taking care of the problems that are most destructive at the time in their lives.
And I'm even open to having this discussion. And I actually, you're the first person I'm talking to publicly, but have the sense, whatever is in my heart, I tend to bring it out. And I'm even thinking of the relevance of deep spiritual sojourns when we are so broken. When we are either materially broken, we have no food, there's war, there is rape, or there is psychological brokenness, as in homes are broken, children are broken, trauma is there. Our religions have become outdated. Is the quest for God and self outdated? Do we just need, are we so broken now, is what I'm wondering. Are we so broken? And I'm willing to have that conversation, and I'll bring it up more in my social media platforms.
So, what about this search do you think might be outdated and might not be relevant to somebody who is having some issues with suffering today? Because I think, at least in the West, and you've had people like Carl Jung and them talking about this for almost a century, even talking about the problems of the soul that are going to arise when we kind of get rid of religions and don't really have anything to replace it with. What seems to be happening is that people are going to start replacing them with pseudo religions, and so it's like this vacancy gets filled in some way. What about these problems that we're having today? You know, I'm mostly only familiar with issues in the West, and specifically with, you know, my peer group, people around my age, so I can kind of only speak from that perspective. But it seems to me like there can be great value in ideas like this. What exactly about it do you think that you're questioning or might want to alter?
I think what I'm questioning is, I think by opening this can of worms, I am willing to face the dark truth that as a humanity, as a collective, we have not evolved, but we've regressed, and that they might be literature or they might be scrolls and mystical teachings that are just beyond us right now. And what we really need now is dharma or ethics to stop being cruel to each other, stop warring at each other, live healthy lives, take care of Mother Nature, like ABCDs almost. And that will make me probably irrelevant and probably make my book irrelevant. But I'm willing to see that. I'm willing to grieve that there was a time once in the planet when we could come up with the Upanishads, which said, Ekam Satvi Praha Bahudha Vadanti, that there are not different truths. People say it differently, but there is only one truth. Vasudeva Kutumbakam, the world is one family. There was a time and there were seers who came up with this radical oneness and union. And today there is a time when children are not safe in their own home. And have it there, or should I just pretend, Jake, to continue teaching those same things just because I can? So this is a very disturbing conversation that I'm bringing up with you, but that just speaks to your consciousness that I can do that.
Well, I mean, it's an honest one and it's authentic one, and it's one that I wasn't expecting to get into, but is really interesting to me. It seems like your work and the work of many other spiritual teachers is living on and is especially taking interest in the West with younger people. It doesn't seem to me that these things are being viewed as irrelevant. It seems like in some way they're being viewed as healing for filling kind of a gap that has, or a vacancy that has become when we've started to throw out religious ideas. That, and it seems to be like many of the problems with religious ideas has more to do with the organizations and the structures around it and some of the things that they've done rather than the ideas themselves. It doesn't seem to me that these ideas are kind of a lost cause. It kind of seems like they may be a solution to something that we deeply need. And, you know, that deep longing for these kinds of ideas and this kind of connection is, you know, it seems like is what's made us prioritize these traditions so much throughout history, and, you know, how they've kind of sat at the root of many of our cultures. When you're teaching now, well, do you think that throughout your career that you've seen a difference in the way that these things are resonating? Or like because it seems like you're having a big impact as well.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and just going back to what you said about how these ideas are relevant, it's almost like I want to now talk to my community or talk to my readers and say, hey, do you choose these ideas? So these ideas are not just in the shopping mall to seduce you into comfort, but are you choosing them because these ideas are so critical to the liberation of humanity from its self-destruction, you know? But yeah. So where I have found only grateful people and thank you notes and flower bouquets, but the conversation I'm having with you is something I'm having privately. It's like, do we just dole out some more spirituality from the Indian Vedas? Here you go. Or should my work be like, hey, there is a path to sovereignty, but there is all this bondage right here. Whether you're trying to seek liberation through mushrooms or, you know, drugs, or through emancipating sex or cults, Capitalism. Can we all just come back and have that conversation? And so I guess, yes, it's relevant, but also contextualizing it and helping people choose it is probably the next type of conversation I'm getting ready to have as a
Yeah.
author, teacher, speaker.
So do you think that it has more to do with the packaging and the delivery of the messages than the actual messages themselves? If people are kind of jaded with some of the ways that things have been talked about in the past, like the word God, even in the United States, is a weird term, and I'm curious about the way that you approach teaching some of these messages to people in the West. Given those kinds of difference in the concepts of God, it seems like it's just there's a lot of things that need clarified and maybe ways that messages are given that can turn people off. Because I'm starting to see people kind of form these same messages but word them in different ways, and people are a little bit more receptive, which kind of tells me that there's certain ways that you can talk about different kind of spiritual or religious teachings that immediately turn somebody off. Do you think it's something that you just are wanting to be careful about in the way that you talk about it, like I said, like the packaging and the delivery?
Oh yeah, I have to be.
Yeah.
Also because the Vedic tradition is so intertwined with the Hindu religion, even though
Mm.
the Vedic tradition precedes any religion born in India, and the Vedic tradition is a way of conscious living. It is not a religion. There were no deities mentioned in the Vedas, but because they're so intertwined that any mention of the Vedic spirituality invariably configures the Hindu tradition. And also, the very mention of the word God or goddess brings up, it's a trigger. It can go either way, but it's definitely not a word that can be used easily. So, in my teachings, for example, I have to bring them back to the Upanishadic understanding of God as pure consciousness, as Satchitananda, an intelligent consciousness that's joy-filled, and it can be most closely found within our own heart, and that it is all-pervading and it dwells in every beating heart, and that it is the source, substance, and essence of our experience. So it takes a lot of words and a lot of explanation to just say the word God.
Right. Yeah.
But I think I'm making some headway because I have former atheists and former agnostics and and all religious people from every background studying with me, because they start understanding that the Vedas talk about the science of the God, great omniscient dimension. They're not, it's not, God is not an anthropomorphic person, personality, human, animal, plant. And if Hinduism, which is very close to the Vedic tradition, has 34 million gods, it's only because what is not God?
Right.
What is not pure consciousness? But oh yeah, it takes a long time to just convey something that, but that's where I have beginner students and advanced, and so it gets a
Right.
little easier to converse with the more advanced students.
One of the things that I'm curious about is so I this idea of liberation, freedom from bondage. How does that pair with structural, spiritual, or religious teachings or prescriptions? Like, what's the balance between, trying to stay away from religious dogma while retaining your freedom, while also following a path that works and having some guide rails?
I think I leave, and I think we should all leave people their own religious choices, whether they choose to agree or disagree. The kind of sovereignty and liberation I talk about is autonomy as a conscious being. Certain religious prescriptions and dogmatic teachings work with that, and some don't. Definitely a person who read Sovereign Self or undergo some training under me through the Vedic tradition, they learn about a word called yoga. And yoga is not physical postures like it's known, but yoga means union. And there are hundreds of types of methods of ways to have union with your own higher divine possibility. Probably yoga is the answer to dogmatic religion because, for example, authenticity can be a path to yoga. Leading a life of accepting all parts of you, even the parts that are broken and small, and refusing to have shame about them can be a source of yoga. So there are actually these teachings in the Vedas about hundreds of ways to be in yoga, or you can, so you kind of, so in a Jungian way, it's like when you remove the shadow and you claim the self, that's when you're in a state of yoga. And there are different ways to do it, like coming clean, speaking the truth, being authentic, accepting yourself. These are all ways to yoga. And naturally, when one learns all this, one has to then readjust or recalibrate the religious dogma in their life. But I don't think I'm the only, or the Vedic tradition is the only impetus to do that. I think as humanity is evolving, we are all having to look at what part of our religious upbringing we want to keep and what part we want to let go. I was born in a Hindu household and I'm a practicing Hindu and a proud Hindu. And yet there are pieces of Hinduism which I refuse to engage with. And then there's this essence of Hinduism which is very close to the Vedic tradition that I wish to keep and rejoice. So I think any kind of learning, whether we go to school, like, go for higher education, or we sit in a social group or a women's circle or a men's circle, we grow. And we get these learning around, but this is the fixed part of our life. This was very given to us. Do I want to keep it, or do I want to keep some part of it? And I think the Vedic tradition overall, at least for teachers like myself, we try and not give dogma. We just say you have choice and choose yourself in the process. Definitely.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So, to kind of stay in touch with how you feel, and here are the tools. Here are some scriptures. Here are some teachers. Here are some methods that you can take. Try what works for you and see how you feel, and just kind of follow that instead of trying to like force yourself to do a certain thing. Because I've even found with myself like one of the most ironic things is when I try to force myself to meditate when I actually like want to get up and like do something else. That feels. Like I've found sometimes meditation works like a charm. Other times it feels like I'm just trying to like strap myself to a chair and then it's actually counterproductive and it takes me out of the state that I'm trying to get into by using meditation. So it's like, so I just like tie myself in a knot and then just have to kind of laugh at myself. So it's like you're trying to find the things that work for you and then use them when they feel right, but don't make it so that you have to, at a certain day, at a certain time, every single, like all the time, constantly, like force yourself to do something.
Oh, absolutely. And liberation does not come from 20 minutes a day meditation in the morning and 20 minutes. If it was that simple a prescription, I mean, gosh. And that's where the concept of yogas are so liberating because we right away say, okay, so meditation is not working, but action might take you closer to you. So karma yoga now is helpful. Karma means action. Go for it. Host your podcast, read a book, have an authentic conversation, and you will be close to you. And so you've already achieved what meditation would have given you. So all those prescriptions, 20 minutes this, 20 minutes that, and 108 times of this mala, ooh, that's really, really, really bad publicity for the Vedic Hindu tradition. It's just not good. This is
Why do you
what
think that stuff developed?
I think people want to be sheep. They want to be told what to do.
You don't like an easy way where you
They
don't have
like
to.
it. They like being given a prescription. They beg me for prescriptions, and I never get
Yeah.
prescriptions. That's why it's a bit overwhelming to be with a teacher like me who pushes them,
Yeah.
pushes them off the cliff and says, "See you later. You'll find your wings."
Yeah.
So.
And like in that at first you have it's overwhelmed if you're too wrapped up in your head, but then kind of eventually you can adapt to it and start to to kind of walk your own path instead of like overthinking all the time. It's a process where at first you're like, I want guidance because I don't know what to do. But it's kind of just like like riding a bike almost. Like you kind of have to just trial and error, like figure it out for yourself because like there's nobody that can feed you what's going to work for you.
Exactly. And I think, Jake, 80% people just want to accommodate some spirituality in their life.
Yeah.
So, like a tiny slice. And for them, having a ritual, a 10-minute this, a 5-minute that really works. But probably I'm not that kind of a teacher, and probably you're not that kind of a person. So, we can have this conversation and laugh about it. For a
Right.
lot of people, that helps. And so it's like, well, you'll have to just find another teacher, who thinks that somehow discipline is going to make you reach nirvana. I don't believe that.
The concept of discipline is kind of weird. Like with stuff like this, it seems like it's almost, it seems like some of the prescriptions and some of the things that we call discipline, it's like you're observing somebody who's kind of doing the thing naturally on their own. And it might look like discipline to from the outside, but maybe it doesn't feel like it from the inside. And then you're trying to like almost reverse engineer it and replicate it for yourself. Do you think that that's how some of these like prescriptions emerge?
I think you said it. I think the people who are chanting, meditating, standing on one leg, and I know many of them, and I have my own things that I do, and we do it from an inner fierceness, an inner passion, an inner romance with it. But then when you try and clone it, convert it into a system or process, it just becomes a forced discipline. So the word for spiritual disciplines in Sanskrit is sadhana, but sadhana should always be voluntary and inwardly driven. It can never be an outer prescription or a homework that somebody has to do. Sooner or later, there is resentment. People don't meditate, then they feel sneaky, guilty. Instead of saying, you know what, I'm just going to listen to this rock music and I'm going to just go into the state of nirvana, which. And I'm not surprised why people then rebel also. And I remember my grandfather, my guru, saying, "This is how you meditate, and you can meditate when you want to." So he just showed me how to, but he never told me when to. And so I didn't meditate for years, and then my eyes spontaneously closed and I meditated. Because I had evolved into that place where meditation was like my nature. And then he had some disciples who were like morning they're meditating, every time he would pass by they're meditating. So he chose me. The non-meditating one.
Is there resentment for things like that in those kinds of communities? Like, do people get worked up if they're like, I did the thing, like I followed all the, I checked the boxes, and like that's what I thought I was supposed to do? But they miss if you're missing the point, like do people get upset about that?
I mean, the human ego, it just
Right.
goes and wears those spiritual robes and then pretends it's all calm and peaceful, but it's still having all those shenanigans of how I got left behind and I meditated 20 minutes more and I chant
Yeah.
every day 1,008 times and she only chants 108 times. But it's a phase. But some of us come through that and we realize that it's all noise. And spirituality is an invitation. It's not a dogma. And And at least I was really fortunate to have a guru who never forced us into anything. He just lived his life like a huge, big ocean. And we were these tiny waves. And so we got to see what that means, you know, to live like a tiny wave or to be like an ocean. So a guru, going back to a guru also teaches when they are quiet. A guru teaches by their behavior, by their choices, how they deal with the ups and downs of life. You know?
So for you, with so many practices, like in the book, it's chock full. Like there's so many different tools, and then like even like outside of your book, just in general, there's a lot that of things that people can try. What's your approach on a regular basis? Is it just kind of like what you're curious about, what feels good to you? Like how do you navigate what to do?
I mean, I gave a lot of practices because, you know, the publishers want you to give a lot of practices and then the readers would buy it and then somebody would benefit from some practice. So just not from pessimism that I provided those. But my go-to practice is authenticity. And my go-to practice is constantly remembering that I am a cosmic being, having a physical, biological, temporary experience. So this is known as the yoga of wisdom, yoga of knowledge. So I use my mind, my intellectual faculty, to constantly discriminate or discern that I am not my body, I'm not my mind, I'm not my intellect, I'm not my ego that's having a heart attack here. I am that pure awareness, that pure consciousness. Probably that's a thought I have. It's like a supra thought over all my other thoughts. Like even now, if my ego says, "Oh, you shouldn't have said that," and "Oh, we could have said that, and we could do this, and we could dress up better, and we could comb my hair," that supra thought of it doesn't matter. Jake is not just Jake, the podcast host, and I'm not just the podcast guest, but this is a cosmic experience happening. It kind of re it relieves me and it releases me to be whole and pure in the moment. I'm like on the top of my game right now talking to you. There's no like before or after. I'm having a joyous time, you know. And if you were a cynical host and I could feel your judgment, like she's not acting like an acharya at all. I would have even more fun at
Why is that? Is
Because
like
then,
playing with
you know,
people?
then it's like frolic. Then it's like, then I become the guru at that time. And then it doesn't matter, you know? Yeah.
So for you, just being present, being in the moment, and just having that awareness
Remembering,
in your
remembering.
mind, having that remembering, that carries the freight for you, and then
That's
everything
my
else is
biggest
kind of,
practice, honestly.
and everything else is just so-called the paths up the same mountain, just like whatever gets you in touch with that, and then so long as you're there, you can drop or pick up whatever you want to.
And like I wake up early in the morning and I like to go out and greet the sun with my arms extended. I have a deity of Ganesha who I'm just totally in love with, and of Durga. And I like to say hi to them. Or I like to pick up wildflowers and decorate their deities. But if I'm away from the deity, or if I couldn't do it one day, or if it's raining, it's not the end of my day. That's play for me. It's a remembrance.
There's one more concept that I thought would be interesting to touch on, that is something that I think about trying to navigate sometimes. It's this idea between, or this idea of healthy versus unhealthy attachments, and discerning between those, while staying authentic. How do you think about navigating, like authenticity while doing things that are healthy behaviors versus unhealthy behaviors? Like it's easy to get attached to things that are viewed as like physically healthy behaviors, like going to the gym, strict diets and things like that, but you're talking about it in a different way in terms of these attachments. Could you discern between those two?
I think we are born to have attachments. The human nature is like that. So attachment does not mean, for me, in the Vedic tradition, it does not mean completely no sex, no food, no TV. That's mm-hmm. not our goal. Unhealthy attachment, on the other hand, is when we lean upon it and its absence captivates us or puts us in bondage of suffering. So my authentic self, authenticity demands that I accept right now that I'm attached to my son, my husband, my dog, you know, I'm attached to this podcast going well. That's our human nature. But the healthy part of it, that's the authentic part, to accept it. And then the spiritual part of it is to say, okay, you should know that I should know that we come alone and we go alone, and that all the people and the animals and the things in our life, they are of transitory nature. They're impermanent, and there is a cosmic intelligence that orchestrates how long this animal will stay in your life, how long your son will be in your life, how long your partner. And so having this remembrance that I'm a cosmic player in a cosmic play, and that people and things are coming to me and people and things are being taken away from me. When they are coming to me, may I act with nobility, dharma. And when they are taken away from me, may I act with nobility and not fall apart. So I think attachment, keeping our attachments from becoming unhealthy attachments, and bringing in some healthy dose of detachment, but not having some abnormal, artificial understanding of detachment. That is not the Vedic way. The Vedic way is the middle path, to say, have it, but don't depend on it. Don't disturb your mind to have it at any cost, because the nature, impermanence is a law. And the only permanent thing within you is your awareness, and you're enough within, and cultivate that. So to answer your question, as an authentic person, I don't deny I have attachments. A lot of Vedic teachers say, I have no attachments. I don't like to say all that, because that would not be fair. I'm actually even attached to chai and chocolate and certain kind of cookie from my favorite Trader Joe's. So I have a whole list there. Am I pathological? No. Am I even dependent upon it? Probably not. I've had periods of no chai, periods of no cookies, periods of no family, and I can be alone. And it's a little uncomfortable, but I'm okay. So I think that way I work with authenticity and kind of keeping my attachment box, inbox, a little clean, not overly stuck, crazy.
So have things that you like, do what you like to do, but just make sure that you don't remain dependent on it, or it's not destructive if you can't have it.
Yeah, I can give an example. Like I really have a close relationship with my husband, and I would really like to touch him when we went to bed, just my hand over him. And then I started experimenting with removing my hand. And saying, are you gonna be okay? Are you gonna be okay? Are you gonna? And then it craved to touch him again. Like I had attachment syndrome going on in the palm of my hand, because it was so used to the familiar touching him while he's asleep. And then I looked at my hand and I said, it's okay. It's all right. Come back, baby, come back. Touched my own heart and like just did a couple of ohms. And now, whether he's sleeping next to me or not, whether I'm touching him or not touching him, my relationship is noble, but I don't need this grasping. So I give this example to my students, grasping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similarly with my first dog, when he died, many, many years ago. I cried and cried. My parrot flew away. I cried and cried. But now, when animals come to me, and many do, I'm like, okay, the universe sent me you. I'm your universal caretaker. I don't know how long you'll stay with me, but while you are with me, I'll keep you as an honored guest. So I try and not get too entangled up and stuff like that.
And that's just back to that awareness, just paying attention to like how you're feeling, and that kind of takes care of that. I mean, really, that takes care of the navigation of whatever path you're walking on, so long as you keep that remembering in mind and you're staying aware.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I'll have your websites and the book and stuff linked. Do you have anything that you would like to let people know about?
No, I think I had so much joy conversing with you. Thank you, Jake.
Cool. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, take care.